Welcome to today's sixth CEU seminar regarding why clients struggle. I'll be your presenter for today's seminar. My name's Michelle Sparks. I'm owner and director of River of Life Professional Counseling. Now, this topic of why clients struggle has been really important to me because often I'll be talking with colleagues, and they'll mention to me that one of the most difficult parts of their job, in spite of all the empathy that they have for clients and in spite of the joy of hearing clients' stories, is that they end up having frustrating clients. They end up having stuck points. They end up feeling like there's impasses, and they really are not sure what to do at that point. So I thought, let's design a seminar that addresses the different functions and issues that are important in terms of creating a good impression on clients, in terms of connecting therapeutically with clients, in terms of dealing with resistance with clients, and dealing with our own issues so they don't impact clients. So today we'll look at all those different areas. By looking at all these different areas, my hope is that ultimately we'll develop a way to deal with potential client struggles and basically cut them off at the pass. One of the things that clients may be impacted by is the bad first impressions. You've heard the saying about first impressions pretty much are everything. That's especially true in the work we do. If someone's presenting as unprofessional, whether it's us as a clinician, whether it's the office staff when they take phone calls or greet people as they come in the door, whether it's associates we work with or volunteers or interns, that can make a big impression that sometimes can be long-lasting and very difficult to break. Another aspect of first impressions that clients tend to look at is whether or not we're on time. If we're saying that they're important to us and dealing with their presenting concerns is something that we value, then one way we can really show that is by being on time for their sessions. Also being present. Are we actually looking at the client when they're talking? Are we listening to what they're saying, not guessing what we're going to say in response next, but really acting interested? Or are we coming across as disinterested, kind of tired, dozing off, looking at the clock, wanting to hurry up and get the session done with, wanting to just get our money? Are we coming across as judgmental? Or are we really having high degrees of Rogers process variables? Things like being genuinely empathic, things like really hearing the client's story and putting ourselves in his or her shoes. Are we having flexibility? Now, I know, depending on the agency you work for, there can be a number of policies that we need to adhere to. There's the mission of the company or the group you work with. There's policies. There may be boards, both for your licensure as well as boards that are governing the type of setting that you're in, whether it be a hospital, a crisis-oriented setting, a private practice, or another type of setting. We want to make sure that we're giving the impression to our clients that we're flexible, that while we do have policies that we must adhere to, and we should have those written down in our policies and procedures for them to know at first glance, we need to be not so policy-oriented that we become impersonal. Now, on the other end of that continuum, we don't want to give a bad first impression by being too laid back, by being so personal that we're so friendly as if we're not a licensed therapist anymore, that we don't have that professional air anymore. We want to make sure that whether it be in writing in our policies and procedures, or in advertising, or in terms of how the office is laid out, that we're very clear about who we are, what our credentials are, the areas of competency that we've been trained in and worked in to this point, and the type of techniques that we use. We want to make sure and stray away from any potentially misleading information. The other thing we'll talk about a little bit later in more depth is that clients have expectations of us. And sometimes what they're expecting or thinking that counseling and psychotherapy involves may not be exactly what we're thinking that counseling and psychotherapy involves. I think one of the most useful questions when you're doing an initial diagnostic assessment is to inquire about if that client has had any previous counseling, what their perception is of what happened during that, or what they think should happen in their sessions with you, what they liked or didn't like. For example, I've had clients that have said to me that they really like someone who listened, paid attention, and was, quote, non-judgmental. I've also had clients that have said, you know what, I really don't just want someone to spit back to me what I'm saying, but I'd like some practical techniques. I want to know what to do about the situations and the presenting concerns I'm coming in with. That's where I think it's really important to hear what types of experiences they've had with any kind of therapy to this point, and what's worked or not worked, what they'd like to see happen. And it also gives us a chance to clarify about if their expectations are in line with what our scope of practice is. I try to keep on hand a form letter that would also in writing show this is what my education was, this is what diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders involves and what that means, and this is what I'm not. I clarify that I'm not a person that does forensic evaluations. I'm not a mediator. I'm not doing visitations or determinations for custody, for example. And one of the other things about first impressions that our clients are looking at is, do they get a sense deep in their heart that where they're coming, where we're working with them, that it is a safe place emotionally? So good first impressions would involve a therapist who's high in Rogers process variables. The literature shows that these process variables are essentially within the therapist's control. Initially, we thought that, oh, if you have a nice, warm, caring client, it's really easy to be welcoming and non-judgmental and kind, empathic, and elicit and give unconditional positive regard. But the fact is, it is possible to have those Rogers process variables even with court or mandated clients, even with resistant clients. And that's why I thought it was so important to present this topic today of why clients struggle. We can empathize with their story and hear it. Again, empathize, not agree with, not necessarily condone or support or reaffirm all of their behaviors if they're toxic, but we can come across as accepting their story and their narrative, as hearing the useful parts of their story or validating whatever could be validated in terms of trying to put ourselves in their shoes. We can also give good first impressions by how we look at the treatment goals and the long-term planning. Do we really individualize to them? Or does the client get the perception that they're just thrown in a group of similar people? For example, would every depressed client feel like they're just getting the same standard treatment? Or do we really try and individualize treatment goals and planning to their specific symptoms and issues surrounding their depression? Another thing we want to reaffirm in terms of good first impressions is that this is a voluntary process and it's a therapeutic partnership, that we're in this together, that we respect clients' opinions and outlook on things. we want to be careful about portraying that idea of us being, quote, the expert coming at them from without, knowing what's better for them in their life. One of the things that also makes a good impression on a client is making sure that our competencies are consistent with what the client's looking for or expecting. Also making sure that if there's areas that we realize we're not competent in, that we're aware of resources and referral sources. And there's genuineness and sincerity in terms of us showing that we want to be of help to them. So in terms of looking at the keys to success in clinical interactions, we're looking at how to balance protocol and policies with flexibility and adaptability. We're understanding what it is that the client might be resisting. We have to be careful not to take personally those times that we think that there's resistance from a client, because really it's not personal. Actually, did you ever think of the fact that if you're doing a good job, if you're really understanding the client's story, that over time they're going to manifest some similar symptoms to what happens in their day-to-day life? We also, in a successful clinical interaction, reconceptualize resistance not as something personal, but that this is really part of a habitual pattern. They're just used to doing things this way. And we help develop reality-based thinking. We realize that our interactions with that client are limited. We're just seeing a small percentage of what happens in their day-to-day life. Another factor that may be a consideration when we're setting the tone for a healthy therapeutic interaction is how the room's set up. Is it perceived as a welcoming setting? For example, is the office set up much like a living room where someone can come in, they're comfortable, the seating is comfortable for them, they don't feel squished in the chair, they don't feel unsupported or hurt by the furniture? Is it welcoming? Is there appropriate lighting to where they're able to see what they need to see in terms of paperwork and you seeing them clearly? Are your disclosure statements and your copies of your licenses displayed in a prominent way to where they can see that? So is the room set up for communication? Deterrence in the room would be uncomfortable seating. It's just not being a welcoming environment, having inappropriate lighting. If it's not structured for communication, or if it's just unprofessional, things that could be helpful or positive in a good setting would be a clean office. I know we're all busy, and some types of settings you may be working in may have productivity standards. You may feel like you're seeing client after client or doing just tons of paperwork. But it's important to make sure that things are clean and welcoming. This is for all areas, including assessments, exam rooms. If you're in a hospital setting, the room that they sleep in, rooms that they meet in, rooms that group therapy takes place in. One of the phrases I'd like you to keep in your mind as we're looking at how to create a warm and inviting environment for the client is that the place that we're at and the services that we provide should be considered as the place of a new start. When you think about that, you can really ask yourself, is the way I'm portraying this atmosphere, is the way I'm portraying myself and my character and demeanor really welcoming them? Like, yeah, you may have had a rough road to this point, but here we're going to start anew. We want it to be a place where what we're role modeling is different from the toxicity that's connected with the presenting problems that they're having. We want to make sure we're not modeling more chaos, more uncleanliness. Clients will think twice if they feel like your sessions are rushed, if they feel like you don't have time to transition from one client to another, if they feel like you're overly focused on money in the business or in personal policies, they'll also feel frustrated if your words are saying one thing and your body language is saying another thing. If you remember in your grad school classes, there was a lot of training about even our nonverbals. And in most situations, it's not just what we say, but as much as 90-something percent of our messages is really what happens with our nonverbals. If you say, I'm here for you, I want to walk alongside you, I'm interested in hearing your story, let's set up some individualized treatment goals, but then your body's leaning towards the door, you're slumped over, you're half falling asleep, you're constantly looking at the clock, the client's going to look at that and see those nonverbals and say, you know what, they might be saying something, but their words and their body language really conflict. I'm not so sure I feel comfortable here. Another thing that makes clients think twice about coming to you is how judgmental you may be. Remember that counseling and psychotherapy isn't the place to debate what someone's like values, beliefs, and opinions are. While a client may be aware of where we stand on an issue, our goal isn't to necessarily indoctrinate them into some way of thinking or get them to change or get them to come to our position. Our goal is to teach therapy techniques that we know are proven and help with their presenting concerns. Another thing that can be a real hindrance to clients when they're first coming in and sharing their narrative is if we're asking them a lot of why questions. They don't necessarily know why they're doing what they're doing. They just know that it's not working. So if you ask them, well, why are you drinking so much? Well, why did you make that decision? Well, why are you continuing in a relationship that's not helpful? We want to stay away from those why questions and just hear the narrative and then look at skill building and techniques that will help them change behavior. So how do we welcome the patients? We need to welcome the patient or the client by having empathy. A client's already coming in with fears and concerns. I mean, imagine meeting a stranger and then having to tell him or her about your concerns. So we need to have empathy with their experience, their anxiety, their caution, their fears. They may have never been to a counselor before. On the other hand, we might have someone who's been to several therapists before. Maybe they've had several inpatient admissions. So we need to look at what's the meaning of being here to the patient, here in this setting at this time. We need to look at if this is really voluntary. Was it the client's idea to come to us? Or was it a strong suggestion that was pushed by a family member, a court, a school, an employer? You might be having a different reaction from the client if they feel like they were forced to come to you. We need to look at what would create an environment or an atmosphere of comfort for them. I love to look at the operational definitions of a client because with operational definitions, we can focus on what the concrete, observable, behavioral definitions of things are. So I might elicit some discussion from the client about what it would look like if their life had more comfort, peace, safety, or security. They may have had this before in their life and it got away from them, or they may feel like they've never had it. But to daydream with the client about what would that look like can help give you some insight into where they like to be progressing towards. Another thing we can do in terms of setting up the atmosphere and making it welcoming is looking at the fact that even mandated clients, court-referred clients, or involuntary clients may still have something that we can agree upon. I know that may sound like a shock to some of you, but one of the ways that I've been able to connect with some people who really didn't have the idea themselves to come in was to try and find out what the smallest agreed upon goal is. So for example, let's take a resistant teenager who feels like he or she was dragged in by their parents. When I talk with that teenager, I might say, you know what? I'm sure you have better things to be doing than being here. I'm sure you'd rather hang with your friends or do your hobbies. This is probably the last place you want to be. And guess what? I don't necessarily want to keep people who don't want to be here either. But you know, since your parents are paying the money and the time and they see these concerns, I want to be an advocate for you. I want to be able to tell them at some point that you really don't need to be coming here, that you're trying, that you're paying attention, that you're willing to set some goals, and that you don't need to be here anymore. This usually shocks a teenager. But what's cool about it is then we can reframe the treatment goals in terms of, what can I do to get my parents to shut up and stop bringing me here? This also can work, for example, with court clients. What can I do to prove to those people that they can get off my case? What can I do to stop having to be on probation? What can I do to just get this over with? If that's the smallest goal that you can agree upon with a client, then I encourage you to let that be the starting point. Another thing is finding out what is right, what is comfortable for that client. You'd be surprised how little things, like having a cup of water, having maybe something to snack on, or a drink available, might help that client just feel like, okay, this is less formal and less fearful than I thought. Showing that we're attentive and acknowledging the patient's perception also sets the atmosphere. We always want to make sure our therapeutic foundations are first, and we have empathic understanding of the story as the client sees it. We want to look at what the client is comfortable with, and ultimately looking at what goals would be manageable and realistic. There may be things that the client wants to get to or you would like to see the client do, but it's important to explore, is what we're thinking realistic? Has the client ever been able to show that he or she could maybe do those behaviors? Do we just need to increase the frequency? Or do we actually need to teach some new skills? It's important to assess those things. We need to also keep in mind our ethical standards, protect against harm, and make sure what we're doing is actually for the good of the client. We need to be ready to deal with resistance, but also, let me add, not be so quick to see everything as resistance. We need to realize, again, that these are patterns that the clients used and, maybe not cognitively, but in some way, even subconsciously, maybe something that they feel is beneficial or has worked for them before. So, it may be several sessions of empathy building and hearing the narrative before you really have that therapeutic alliance and connection. We need to be careful with our timing in terms of challenging and confronting. This could be one area that the client struggles with. If we challenge and confront them on things too early, that could create resistance. They could bolt. They could terminate early. So we need to consider, when we're thinking of challenging or confronting something, what can the client legitimately understand? Are they really ready to see, for example, their resistances, their defense mechanisms, and the things they've used for what they are? Are they really at a place of readiness to look at, I want to do something new? We'll talk after a little bit here about the stages of change in the therapy process. And one of the critical things about timing, challenging, and confronting, or even any intervention for that matter, is making sure We see where the client's really at in terms of his or her stages of change. Remember, just because someone's coming in for therapy doesn't mean they're ready to take action and change at that point in time. They may be coming in to fulfill a requirement. They may be coming in because they were given a threat by someone. They may be coming in for a whole host of different reasons. So, again, with challenging and confronting, we need to look at the timing, the policies about how do we do this in a kind way. I like to use what I call the communication game. I like to use these three parts of the iMessage formula to try and understand where the client's coming from. So first of all, I want to try and understand what the client's feeling. I want to summarize that. Oh, so were you feeling sad? Sounds like you're feeling disappointed. I'm hearing you say that you were pretty angry because you felt that that ended up happening different from the way you thought it would. Oh, you feel this because. So the second part would be looking at the situation as they see it. And the last part would be understanding what they hope would happen. Then we have, once we've understood those three parts, we have actual concrete things that we can work with in session. We can either look at what their words are saying versus their behaviors, what their words are saying time one versus time two. We can look at what their behaviors are saying time one versus time two. And ultimately, one of the areas we really need to look at in terms of dealing with potential client struggles is how we come up with our treatment goals. Are they concrete? Are they things that can actually be observed? Are they behavioral? This is why when I'm talking about presenting concerns, let's say a client's coming in for depression or communication problems or anger management, we're using the idea of what I call a camera check. What would an imaginary video camera see in terms of concrete, observable behaviors that would be positive alternatives to what's contributing to the presenting concerns? So when we're talking about concrete, observable behavioral goals, we're looking at what can I really give the patient that will show that I'm interested in his or her goals. Keep in mind that we might be the only person in that client's whole life who hears and acknowledges anything that they're thinking. That's pretty powerful. We have the power through therapeutic connection to help someone to want to maybe change or learn things or approach things differently. And we also have the power to maybe break someone further. So we really need to keep in mind that we might be the one different person in their life. I've had numerous clients that have said, wow, you know, I felt like no one ever listened to me or heard me or understood me. This is the first time I felt that. That's not so unusual for our clients. They're sometimes taking a risk to even come in to meet a new person. So that's something we really need to affirm with them. We need to help them know that we realize that this is something new for them. What's the client thinking about? They want to know ultimately, has the therapist heard me? Is the therapist understanding my priorities? One of the things that may be important to a client is that their values, their beliefs, and their worldview are seen as meaningful. Remember, clients come into us with ideas about what constitutes health and wellness, what constitutes a presenting concern, and what may be part of the solution. They want to understand whether or not the therapist understands what's meaningful to them. They want to see if we can relate to their ideas about disease, disorders, and wellness. They want to know if we've really heard the differences between where they're coming to us with the presenting problems versus where they'd like to be. Then they want to know and have the reassurance that not only have we heard them, but that we might be able to help them do something about it. So when we're looking at client and therapist goals and trying to merge those into a unique, individualized treatment plan, we're looking at developing specific goals, things that are measurable and achievable. One of the areas that clients end up struggling, and to be honest, we end up struggling also as therapists, is sometimes when our goals are really not what they should be. If they're too broad or general, like to reduce overall level of depression, that's going to be hard to achieve because we need to look at what behaviors for that given client are constituting depression. Are they staying locked up in their house and not going out as they used to? Are they having difficulty doing their ADLs? Are they basically having a hit or miss performance regarding showing up to work? So if we use that idea that I mentioned earlier of the camera check, we can develop some specific, measurable, and achievable goals. We can look at what would the behaviors be that we're working towards. We also can have increased success because we're looking at small goals and manageable parts. We want to frame things in terms of everything doesn't have to change all at once. Now, oftentimes clients are coming in because they feel overwhelmed and because they wish things had changed a while back for the better. But usually I might make a comment to the effect of how it's taken time to get to the point that they're at right now, and it may take some steps and time to develop new behavior, but that I'm committed to that process with them. That I would rather see them work on one or two small goals and feel like they can succeed at that, and we go step by step, than trying to change too much or have too big of a goal to where they just feel defeated and then just stop therapy. We want to use evidence-based types of techniques and tailor them to the specific client. When our clients are coming in, a lot of times one of their biggest roots, I would say, of any problem, whether it's depression, anxiety, substance use, addiction, mood disorder, personality disorder, anger issues, interpersonal relationship problems, go down the whole list. Basically, the main thing they're having in most cases is a root of shame. Shame is a subjective emotion that says it's not so much my behavior that needs to be changed as much as I must be a flawed person. And this is something that we can have a significant impact on. The literature shows that clients want to know if they matter. They want to know if it would even make a difference if they weren't here. So oftentimes, shame is linked to this perception of their identity. Because of their presenting concerns, clients struggle with the idea of even coming in. They might be so narrowly focused on how they see themselves as flawed that they lose all sense of context. Like I said, they're no longer focusing on a presenting problem or a behavior, but they're seeing themselves as flawed. This results in a sense of paralysis. They feel immobilized. They feel stuck. Like I said, in terms of stages of change, they may not even feel sure that they want to make change or that they can make change. They really feel desperate. So in terms of root of shame, there's an inner perception of inadequacy. There's a belief that they're inherently flawed and imperfect. There's a premise that it's impossible for someone to even love them because they're defective. And so really one of the best things we can do in terms of helping clients through that struggle is focusing on the behaviors, affirming the small steps we can, even if it's just the fact that they showed up to an appointment, that they took a risk, that they reached out, that they made their needs known, that they're willing to explore some things that may not be the most comfortable. The root of shame also tells a client that if I feel less than I should be and I don't measure up, then other people must think that about me too. They feel rather self-conscious. And so we want to normalize the treatment experience, that they're not alone. When a person feels ashamed, they have a negative, global, stable type of idea that their attributes are unchanging, that they're part of them. They fear criticism. They fear judgment. They fear we're going to find out just how flawed they are in terms of what they think they already know. So basically, this necessitates a cover-up. They want to keep secret the bad things about themselves. So if we were to normalize, again, not affirm, not agree with, but to normalize some of their struggles in terms of things that might cause sadness, anxiety, or depression, then they might realize that it's not that they personally are so flawed. So they may come in with a sense of disappointment in themselves or presenting as a false self. Keep in mind they may be coming out of a situation where there's a sense of chaos, where they're not sure how they got to the point of having to come to see a counselor. You might hear a lot of statements that are related to feeling hopeless or helpless. They may not even know what to do or where to go from here. They probably will show some things, even non-verbally, in terms of feeling like giving up. They might look away from you, for example, feeling like if they look at you that you'll almost see through them to the depth of the hurt and pain that they're having. They might slouch in the chair, symbolically feeling the weight of all the things that they've gone through in their life. They might shrug their shoulders and just kind of wonder, how in the world am I going to get to a better place? So there's lack of resolution, resentment, ambiguity. And it's not abnormal even to see, in some situations, game playing because they're just not sure what to do. Shame makes the client feel worn out and tired. We can use the acronym TIRED, T-I-R-E-D, to look at the points that a client has when they're feeling ashamed. Trapped, indicted, responsible, exposed, and defensive. Imagine, just think of those words I just said. Trapped. A client struggling because he or she may feel like there's just a no-win situation. They may feel like they're not good enough. We know when we do cognitive behavioral therapy that one of the red flags that I tell clients is the word enough, because it's so subjective. How will I know when I've done, quote unquote, enough? They may feel indicted. Their mind is mulling over and over what they perceive as their own inadequacies. They may have taken on not just responsibility for realistic behaviors that need to be changed, but for those around them, for more than their share of things. They feel exposed, and they feel defensive. There's a story that I've cited that's in the literature called A Parable of the Prisoner in the Dark Cave. And this is a useful story, whether individual or even especially in groups and group therapy, Because what it does is it looks at how a lot of time there's answers near us, beside us, but because we're so hurt, so ashamed, and so overwhelmed, a lot of times we don't see those. So I'm going to read through this story, and I've actually typed out the story and cited it so that you can use it when you do therapy with clients as well. It really can be a good discussion piece to look at how the clients might feel trapped, might feel that this imaginary countdown is on of they don't have so much time left to deal with or change behaviors, and to where ultimately the answers are near, but it's hard to see them when they're at this point of shame. There once was a man who was sentenced to die. He was blindfolded and put in a pitch black cave. The cave was 100 yards by 100 yards. He was told there was a way out of the cave, and if he could find it, he was a free man. After a rock was secured at the entrance to the cave, the prisoner was allowed to take the blindfold off and roam freely in the darkness. He was to be fed only bread and water for the first 30 days, and nothing thereafter. The bread and water were lowered from a small hole in the roof at the south end of the cave. The ceiling was about 18 feet high. The opening was about 1 foot in diameter. The prisoner could see a light up above, but no light came into the cave. As the prisoner roamed and crawled around the cave, he bumped into rocks. Some were rather large. He thought if he could build a mound of rocks and dirt that was high enough, he could reach the opening and enlarge it enough to crawl through and escape. Since he was 5 feet 9 inches and his reach was another 2 feet, the mound had to be at least 10 feet high. So the prisoner spent his waking hours picking up rocks and digging up dirt. At the end of 2 weeks, he had built a mound of about 6 feet. He thought if he could duplicate that in the next 2 weeks, he could make it before his food ran out. But as he already used most of the rocks in the cave, he had to dig harder and harder. He had to do the digging with his bare hands. After a month had passed, the mound was 9.5 feet high, and he could almost reach the opening if he jumped. He was almost exhausted and extremely weak. One day, just as he thought he could reach the opening, he fell. He was simply too weak to get up, and in 2 days he died. His captors came to him to get his body. They rolled away the huge rock that covered the entrance. As the light flooded to the cave, it illuminated an opening in all of the cave about 3 feet in circumference. It was the opening to a tunnel that led to the other side of the mountain. This was a passage to freedom the prisoner had been told about. It was in the south wall, directly under the opening in the ceiling. All the prisoner would have to do was crawl about 200 feet, and he would have found freedom. He had been so completely focused on the light that it never occurred to him to look for freedom in the darkness. Liberation was there all the time, right next to the mound he was building, but it was in the darkness. What a neat story. I mean, when I came upon this, I thought, this is phenomenal. This is exactly the way some of our clients feel when they come to us. They feel trapped. They feel stuck with regards to the presenting concerns that they're coming in with. They feel like they've done so much work. Actually, a lot of times our clients will even use the word everything. They'll say, I feel like I've tried everything and nothing's working. And so we'll process through with them, what have they tried?
what is everything. But sometimes it's a matter that they keep doing over and over the same things and expecting something to be different. Oftentimes, it's the simple solutions. It's the things that are not considered, but the things that are the breakthrough that they're close to. Just like in this story, there was an opening to the tunnel that was not too far away. What I like is the end of the story where it says, he was so completely focused on the light, it never occurred to him to look for freedom in the darkness. Liberation was there all the time, right next to the mound he was building, but it was in the darkness. This is an analogy I think a lot of our clients can relate to. They're trying to get out of their problem situations rather than reframing it in terms of how even within some of the problem situations, or even in spite of the problem situations, there can be a change of direction, a change of response. It's not necessarily because all the problem situations have gone away, or the people that were triggers have magically behaved the way we hope them to. But oftentimes, it's in spite of things that we learn new perspective. We learn new skills. And that's what makes a difference. The internal messages that clients come to us with are essentially things like, I'm hopelessly flawed. I don't measure up. I'll never be accepted, wanted, or needed just as I am. I'm a failure. I'm a mistake. I'm alone. I'll never be loved as I am. I'm okay if I think, say, or do what the other person wants, but everything is contingent on that. Only perfect relationships matter. I really like using cognitive behavioral methods with clients because they look at identifying the triggers, the triggers to irrational thoughts. One of the authors out there talks about the issue for our clients really being that they have a tendency to tell themselves a story that's negative and toxic. So he talks about how to essentially fill in the blanks in this formula I'm going to read you. He talks about identifying the vulnerable situation, the feelings associated with feeling vulnerable, the defenses that are used against that vulnerability, the fears and worries that come with that, what is really needed, what concrete behaviors are really desired, and then ending with a specific, observable behavioral request. So an ideal comment as we've gone through therapy would be, when I'm blank, I feel blank. And I defend against those feelings by doing such and such. I fear blank. And what I really need or desire in this time is blank. It would help me if you would be willing to blank. So we're teaching clients the cognitive behavioral strategies. Oftentimes, like I said, they're coming to us with patterns that are habitual. Patterns that, while they haven't worked, are really all the client might know. So I start by helping clients identify what I call the red flags, shoulds, if only statements, which make the client assume that life is much more linear than it is. If only I would have done A, B, and C, or if only the other person, or if life or circumstances would go a certain way, then I could. Another red flag is have-tos. That really limits things because we feel like there's no other way of looking at things. There's no choices. Another way clients would feel trapped is by having thoughts that think in terms of absolutes. Good versus bad. Right, wrong. Success or failure. So we're helping teach this cycle to the clients of how, while they may be coming in wanting different feelings, we might not be able to directly change the feelings, but we can indirectly change them by looking at identifying irrational thought patterns and changing those. We can look at how to identify behaviors that are not useful or helpful or actually take them away from healthy goals. Then we help the client identify irrational misbeliefs, teach cognitive debating strategies, and develop renewed thoughts and behaviors that help them overcome the hindrances. I tend to use a lot of handouts with my clients. And one of the things that I'll look at in depth with clients are the 12 toxic thought patterns. I'll have them self-report as I go through these, which ones they feel are most pertaining to them. And then we'll discuss through specific examples of times that they've used these. Using specific examples helps because that way I can also teach them the cognitive debating strategies for how to overcome those examples. So things like awfulizing and catastrophizing, really predicting negative outcomes. If A, B, and C happens, life is over. Things just cannot be born anymore. It's just too much. Another toxic thought pattern is disqualifying or discounting. Basically, discounting the positive and only looking at the negative. So even when something good happens, the person who's coming in that's battling shame, who's really focused on the presenting concern, may discount any of the positive. All or nothing types of belief. Looking at extremes. Things are polarized, they're black and white instead of being in the gray areas. This is another warning thing that we will look at. Or low frustration tolerance, the belief that they just can't handle anymore. Self-downing or other downing. Another one is emotional reasoning. A lot of times I've had to talk with clients about how oftentimes memories are stored in our bodies as emotions. And so sometimes people will reason backwards. They'll think that, oh, I remember last time when I felt this way. Last time I felt this way, I was anxious because such and such happened to me. So now I'm feeling that again. So there must be a warning sign here. Fact of the matter is, just because something feels like a very, very strong situation doesn't mean it's necessarily a truth. Another toxic thought pattern is labeling or stereotyping things based on some limited information or trying to predict things based on limited information. Overgeneralizing is another toxic thought pattern because a person's making broad conclusions based on limited information. One of the most useful things we can do with a client is also helping them to identify and test out assumptions. A lot of times clients will jump to the worst, or their assumptions may not be accurate if we're able to really pinpoint them and challenge them. Sometimes clients will personalize things that maybe really aren't about them. And they may believe these absolute shoulds or these rules. So we'll go through these things. Keep in mind, we're talking today about why clients struggle. They struggle because just like any of us, they are prone to these automatic thought patterns. And sometimes they've thought them and felt them so long that to think or do otherwise really is a challenge. One of the other reasons they struggle is because oftentimes they're appraising situations as more threatening, more worrisome, more harmful than they might actually be. Think of the client with social anxiety. He or she is thinking, oh, if that person's looking at me, it must be for a negative reason. They must be judging me. They must be thinking something bad. They must know how I really am. And they're assigning a likelihood of a high percentage to this irrational thought. 95% sure that it's got to be that they're looking at me because there's something wrong with me. So one of the ways that we can help struggling clients is by helping them reappraise social situations. We can help them create social skills. We can help them feel more in control of things that they don't feel in control of. And one way to do this is actually help them approach anxiety instead of staying away from it. Helping them create even one social mishap per week and basically realizing that the world doesn't cave in. It's interesting because it's like the situation's so built up in the client's mind that the worst thing really doesn't happen. So we encourage clients when we're doing this social reappraisal theory to actually focus on their environment, the real concrete factors, rather than just their subjective perception. In other words, we're encouraging them to tell the whole truth, to realistically appraise the cost, to reframe things so they have a little more sense of control. We're helping them restructure their thoughts. Remember, like I said, these dysfunctional thoughts are automatic and habitual. So we're helping them replace anxiety-producing thoughts with more socially adaptable ones. We're helping do Socratic questioning. We're addressing and questioning the veracity of their assumptions. We're looking at considering if it's a possibility to have new attitudes about themselves and others and what outcomes those might have. So we're helping through exposure as well, not just the thought patterns, but new behaviors, realize that they can reduce the overall frequency and intensity of disabling behaviors. They can find exceptions to things they feel are actual rules. They can systematically face things that are feared or uncomfortable and redirect their attention. Clients want to know when they're coming in, when they're uncomfortable, can they trust us? Do we really care? Is it just a job or a paycheck? Are we attentive? Do we really want to hear their story? Not the story as we want it to be, but the story as they're saying it, as they're experiencing it. In other words, they want to know what the professional's agenda is. Does the professional also care about their agenda? And like I said, even with mandated clients or clients who feel trapped into coming, we can look at even the smallest thing we can mutually agree upon. Through cognitive reframing, we can turn problems into possibilities. Keep in mind that our interaction with them through the therapeutic alliance, the reinforcing that their story and that they as a person matter, really can be the biggest breakthrough ever. It's not necessarily just in the techniques we offer, though those are important and essential, but the connection, that therapeutic connection, really goes a long way. One of the things I like to do with clients is model a solution-focused approach, because with a solution-focused approach, we're looking at, even in the midst of where clients feel trapped and feel like they're just stuck and there's nothing they can do, there might have been something that they tried or did before that to some degree worked. And we could actually build on the things that have worked for them before. We could increase the frequency. We could modify things a little bit, which is somewhat easier than having to learn a brand new behavior. I love the question that the solution-focused folks have of how have you managed in spite of. I think that plants a really neat seed in our client's mind that they have managed. They don't feel like they've managed. They don't feel like they're a conqueror or that they've survived certain things. But it basically says to the client indirectly, things are manageable. That something's manageable, even in the midst of chaos. We can focus on strengths within the client. They came to us to talk. They allow themselves to be vulnerable, even though they've had a lot of vulnerability in relationships that hasn't turned out well. I like the solution-focused approach because it's really a success-driven model. We're looking at solutions, we're building upon what's worked before, and it's a cooperative approach with the client. Clients coming in feeling defeated, feeling like there's a struggle even about coming in. But when we help them realize they've managed, then they start to realize there are resources within them already. There's some tenets of the solution-focused approach that I think really help people when they're struggling, just coming into us. First of all, the solution-focused approach helps the client realize no problem happens all the time. It's not possible to have those absolutes. It may feel like they've had more than their share of trials and issues in life. That's true. We don't want to minimize the feelings of frustration they have. But the fact of the matter is, everything bad doesn't always happen to them. Solutions can be there. They're just not oftentimes in any of our life implemented enough. So we can actually ask some questions to the client to help them feel a little bit empowered. When do you not have the problem? I like that question because when the client's coming in, the typical psychotherapy approach is to really hyper-focus on the problem. Oh, tell me about how that feels. Tell me about how that robs your sleep. Tell me about how it impacts your relationships. Oh, how awful that is. How long has it been going on? What is it? What effect is it having on you? And that, again, just keeps us so problem-focused. But what would it be like if we changed our language and through the narrative empowered clients who are struggling to see that there are some times, may not feel like it's often, but there are some times that they do not have the problem. Another way of stating this without denying the client's stress is saying, when is the situation less bad? We can plan for alternatives to the presenting problem. I like this quote that I listed on the next slide here. According to the solution-focused approach, there are no problems, only opportunities. There are no failures, only learnings. There are thousands of solutions. There are no uncooperative people, but only people with unique ways of cooperating. So when we're talking about moving beyond client struggles. Sometimes the simplicity of the process variables can't be highlighted enough. No studies have ever been found to say that there was anything negative as a byproduct of having these process variables. That's interesting. Because, you know, we could debate what techniques and therapies work better or work worse. But what's interesting, process variables are something that pretty unanimously in the literature have been affirmed. Process variables are a reflection of the intimate back and forth dynamic between the client and the professional. But the more they've studied process variables, the more they've realized that we have a lot more in our control and power than we've given ourselves credit for. Even when we have a personality disorder client, even when we have a mandated client, there is something in terms of empathy, positive regard, respect, and sincerity that we can give this client, that we can choose to have, and we can demonstrate. It's not so much how specialized of a degree the person has, how many techniques they know, but even more so, the demonstration of these process variables. That's fascinating to me. When they've done studies, they looked at which did clients believe was most helpful in terms of a therapeutic relationship. Was it someone with a bachelor's degree? Was it someone with a master's who knew some about techniques and had some process variables? Was it someone with an advanced degree who really knew a lot more about techniques? And actually, what the literature found in the studies is that clients preferred someone with high levels of process variables, regardless of if their education was a PhD level or master's level. So it's not simply having tons of techniques. What do we portray in terms of therapeutic alliance and our day-to-day interactions during sessions with the client? So there are some critical factors that clients hit on. They found that something that was important to them in terms of therapeutic alliance was making encouraging statements, making positive comments, and greeting them. Things that they liked specifically were when they were asked questions. Basically, when we invited more about their narrative. When we reflected back feelings to the point that they could clarify or that they would feel like we really cared about their story. When we were honest and they could tell we were not just saying something and doing something different. When we validated what we were able to validate of their experience. Simple things like making eye contact with them. When we looked at details that they said in their story and went back and used the language they used. When we looked at them, sat forward, showed that we were interested, not fidgeting or giving nonverbals like we really didn't care. When we appropriately use self-disclosure, when we gave the client some degree of control about what they could talk about, and when we minimized administrative types of issues. One of the biggest concerns as we're talking about increasing process variables then is for a client to not feel listened to. We oftentimes have this false assumption that the speakers are the ones that control the communication. But the fact is it's really the listeners that control the communication. When we think, oh, I can just turn on and off listening, clients can tell when we're faking it. And it's not true that just because someone starts talking that other people listen. So things that we need to be aware of in our dynamics with clients is that we can actually open up communication by engaging or shut it down by tuning out. Listeners have actually even more power than the speakers in the communication because they can use their will to tune in or tune out a person. The listener also has a lot of control because that's the one who puts his or her interpretation into things. Listeners evaluate whether messages are meaningful or not and what parts are meaningful. They decide what parts of what the speaker said they're going to follow through on or respond behaviorally to. As I insinuated, listening is just not automatic. And keep in mind when someone's sharing a lot of details, really listeners can just focus on about 4 details at a time. Listening is an art. It takes time and practice. It may sound like one of the most simple things that we learned in grad school. Looking, paying attention, nonverbals. But fact of the matter is it's not automatic. But it's one of the things, as a gift, we essentially can give our clients that will help them feel connected. The things we want to avoid are acting like we're listening, but really tuning out. Or really kind of half-heartedly listening and throwing a little comment in there to try and pretend they're listening. I think one of the biggest things that is a turn-off to a client is when they feel like we choose to focus on a certain thing that they're saying and not another part of it. When we're rehearsing what we're going to say next. Or when we make assumptions based on what they're saying instead of really hearing the narrative. One of the things I like to include in these seminars is about the different listening preferences, because one of the things that can be really helpful to our clients or even just in general in our day-to-day life is when we are listening to something to try and find out what type of person that this is that is talking. Because there's really 4 different listening preferences. They're being people-oriented, action-oriented, time-oriented, or content-oriented. People-oriented listeners are those who are other-focused. The relationship is what's important to them. They're focused on caring and warmth. They're focused on connecting without judgment. They are focused on wanting someone to give clear verbal and nonverbals. They like to relate to what the other person's going through and where they're coming from. Really understand the feelings. So building the actual therapeutic relationship is really what's important to them. They'll notice details in terms of their relationships with others. Problems are that sometimes with a people-oriented listener, they might be overwhelmed because they're focusing so much on people's feelings. They're so empathic that they don't move beyond just the Rogers process variables to actual techniques. Someone who is just a people-oriented listener may actually be more prone to burnout because they don't see the client's story just as his or her story. They see it as if it's their own story. They're quite literally putting themselves in their client's shoes. They're not discriminating. They're not filtering between having some boundaries in relationships. So people-oriented listening is something you want to be aware of if you think you have a client who's like this. Are they wanting to connect interpersonally in terms of the therapeutic alliance? Is that what's meaningful to them? That could be very beneficial in the sense of, especially if they have toxic relationships in their day-to-day life. And if we can role model some different dynamics or different responses. Now, what about the action-oriented listeners? We might have someone who's so focused on the task at hand. They don't like someone to be disorganized. They might seem impatient to some people, but they have expectations and they want to get the things done. They want to see things add up and be handled. They might be impatient with people who just go on and talk too much. So if you have a client who's more of an action-oriented listener, don't spend a long, detailed time talking about why you're going to use what technique. Explain it, but sort of get to the point. Give a few points. Basically, the literature would say keep your points to 3 points or less. Be short and to the point. Speak quickly. They're focused on getting the job done. These are people who may come in, they really like homework. They really like assignments, practical things, role plays, demonstrations of new skills. Then we have content-oriented listeners. They evaluate every angle of things. They like to dig below the surface to dissect problems. They like the technical information. They like looking at the complexities of things. But the problem is some people may find them overly detailed because they're asking questions, looking at the details, kind of looking at several different angles of things. So if you have a client who tends to be more content-oriented, you may want to provide the data. So if you're saying a certain technique is what you believe might be beneficial for them, be prepared that if they tend to be a content-oriented listener, they may want to know why. Why did you pick this technique and not that technique? They want to know what, quote, the experts say. What are the statistics? What are the outcomes? How likely is this to ameliorate my problem? Then the last type of listener is the time-oriented listener. They like boundaries in conversations. They really don't want time wasted. And they get frustrated if there's just fillers in terms of time and the job's not getting done. So they get impatient with time wasters, as they would see it. They may interrupt other people because, again, they want to get to the point and get the job done. They struggle at concentrating and just hearing others in the moment. They tend to be run by the clocks or by the watches. So sometimes things aren't as spontaneous. So one of the things, if you have or you have an inkling that you might have a client who's more time-oriented, you may want to start your session with something like, okay, we have 45 minutes here. Last time we talked about A, B, and C, I wanted to check in about what might be the place to start today. Did you have any important things you wanted to make sure we discussed? And maybe make sure you're sticking to a plan of action. Also, with a time-oriented listener, you may want throughout the session to kind of have some landmark times where you're saying, okay, we have talked about this for a little while, but I'm realizing we only have about 10 minutes left. I want to be able to make sure to get you some practical things you can do beyond the session. Oh, I want to make sure that we don't shortchange such and such. Do we need to schedule another session to continue? So really looking at time limits. We need to make sure, again, that we're not jumping ahead. We're not interrupting. We're not looking at other things like their clothes, their tone of voice, sounds going on. But we're really showing genuine interest. We're not just trying to conclude what they're saying. We definitely want to avoid the yes, but. We want to be careful about trying not to relate things just to ourselves and really show that we're listening. Remember, nonverbals as well can really make up to about 93% of a person's message. So that's what the client's looking at. are your nonverbals really affirming what you're saying? When you say you care, you want to hear my story, you're here for me, we can change things, we can address your problem issue. Are you really reinforcing that? So things that the literature would suggest are important are looking directly at the client, leaning slightly in, having a gentle smile, stating the person's name, taking turns communicating. It's really important during the counseling session that it's neither polarized by the client or by the therapist. If either of those happen, that could be a red flag that maybe this really isn't a therapeutic partnership. Another thing that can be done in terms of nonverbals is learning to angle your body toward the speaker, to give head nods, and to reflect what the client's going through. We're going to stop after this first section here for a little bit, and then we'll start the second section looking at the client's expectations and that issue I referred to earlier regarding stages of change. Wanted to go back and just summarize some of the things that we talked about in this first section. When we're talking about creating a welcoming environment, first impressions are just as important in the counseling and psychotherapy office as anywhere else. A client will make a split-second judgment about how professional we are, how interested, if we really want to hear his or her story, if we're judgmental, if we're too much in the expert role and too impersonal, or if we're too personal and not able to offer them anything clinically. The setup of the office, the mannerisms, the degree of the process variables all make an impact on the client. They can tell we're not tricking them if we're saying we're welcoming and then our behavior is doing something different. So we can't highlight enough the importance of the therapeutic foundations, Rogers process variables, and then developing manageable, behavioral, concrete, realistic goals that are individualized to the client. Timing is everything. I talked about with challenging and confronting, sometimes that's done too early to where it may push a client away. We need to make sure that the goals are concrete and observable. There's something the client can achieve, and that they reinforce the idea that the therapist has heard them and is interested in their stories and willing to hear the priorities according to the client. Oftentimes, this could be where one of the stumbling blocks occur, where the therapist has an idea about what the goal should be, but the client has a different idea. We talked about when clients are coming in, regardless of the issue, almost all of them are struggling with this root of shame. The subjective perception that they're inherently flawed, they're imperfect, that other people can tell that they're unable to handle things. They just have a sense of desperation. I use the idea of the parable of the cave to illustrate the fact that sometimes it's in the dark place, in the midst of the presenting concerns, or while they're going through and coming out of the presenting concerns, that actually the answers and the solutions are there. We talked about cognitive behavioral strategies being useful in terms of identifying irrational thoughts and behaviors that may need to be changed. We talked about how to help a client identify the stories and the vulnerability that he or she may tell themselves. Ultimately, one of the things over time that we want to do with a client, once we've built the therapeutic foundation, is to help them do some social reappraisal, to test their assumptions, and to restructure their thought patterns. We talked about how solution-focused approaches really can make a difference with clients, because they're looking at what the client has managed. They're looking at strengths. And they're assuming that at some point, even though the client may not feel like he or she is so strong and successful or has any skills within them, that there are, even in the worst case, some skills there that can be built on. They might just need to be applied differently in different situations, different timing or frequency. I highlighted how we just can't go wrong with increasing the level of Rogers process variables. All of the factors that the client said that helped them to feel like there was a good therapeutic alliance related back heavily to Rogers process variables. And then I ended up by talking about listening and how really the listeners control the conversation by tuning in, by being present, by hearing the client's narrative, by trying to match their style to the person who's talking and tailoring it to exactly what the clients need. We talked about the type of things we want to avoid in terms of hindrances. We want to make sure that we're staying away from stuff like jumping ahead, guessing what the person might say next, not looking at them or interrupting them, or not really showing interest in what they're saying. Thank you for joining me for this first session of the seminar on Why Clients Struggle. And we'll return shortly to continue talking about clients' perceptions and the differences with therapist perceptions, as well as issues surrounding the topic of stages of change.